Mormon Stories Podcast is made possible through the financial contributions of its listeners. To keep it alive and available to future generations, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org.
You're very kind, and I'm honored to be here and honored that you would come to listen. I'm here by permission from the Department of Microbiology and Molecular Biology and the College of Life Sciences. That's not to imply any sponsorship. I alone am responsible for what you'll hear tonight, and I'm not representing views of BYU or my college or department. I think that there are three questions which thoughtful people will inevitably ask about the subject of homosexuality. And they are related to one another, and in fact, they sit together in a nested set. And at the center is the issue of cause. Even if we were to be able to know everything there is to know about the origin of sexual orientation, it would still be intellectually important and spiritually important for us to ask whether orientation is changeable. Exploring these two complex issues would naturally lead us to try to understand what it's like to be a gay or lesbian Latter-day Saint. Tonight, the topic is the first of these, the cause of homosexuality. So let's rephrase the question in these terms. Perhaps most often, this issue is reflected in the question, do gay and lesbian people choose their orientation? I'm going to begin with a very brief introduction to the topic of human sexual development. Women have two X chromosomes, and those two X chromosomes create a default biological system. Humans with two X chromosomes develop ovaries and a female brain, and that female brain is most often adapted to be attracted erotically and romantically to males. Boys are different than girls. Men have a Y chromosome, and the Y chromosome changes the default program of human development. There is a gene on the Y chromosome that has been identified and cloned, and its function very well described. And one of its primary consequences is the presence in relatively large quantities of the steroid hormone testosterone. Sexual orientation is about the programming of the human brain. Testosterone is responsible for that in a complex way. Sometimes testosterone itself will activate receptors and begin biochemical signaling in the brain. Sometimes it is converted to a related testosterone-like compound, which can do some of that brain programming. And then non-intuitively, testosterone in the male brain can be converted by this enzyme, I'd like you to remember its name for a few minutes, aromatase, into the female steroid hormone estrogen. Estrogen programs a male brain to be male. Now, this program is complex, and it's not the same in every species. the degree to which each of those has an impact in programming the brain and the reproductive biology of a person is different in humans than it is in other mammals. These then are the actors. This ring system that you see is the biochemical basis for steroids, and it begins with the production of the molecule cholesterol. Fancy biochemical footwork can convert cholesterol into these other examples of steroid hormones. We're going to begin looking at the evidence for how sexual orientation is programmed by looking at sexually dimorphic traits. I'd like to make it clear at this point that the empirical studies that I'm going to report to you, that I have not been a direct participant in any of those studies. I come to you as a student of the subject. I have tried to keep abreast of this issue for 20 years. It's not going to be possible for me to tell you all that might be said about this subject. This is an exercise in self-control that I may not be able to succeed very well in, because there's a lot to say. It's also important for you to know that there are important nuances about the studies relative to this subject. Many of them have been repeated in different laboratories, but seldom do those repetitive studies use the same sample of individuals. Sometimes the definition of who is a gay or lesbian person changes somewhat. The statistical treatment of the data is not always uniform. I won't attempt tonight to address all of those subtleties. I've come, I hope, prepared to tell you what I think the big picture is across these many studies. All right, so what's a sexually dimorphic trait? I've tried to represent that for you in this cartoon. A sexually dimorphic trait is a biological or psychological trait that's different between men and women. And the experiments then have tried to determine whether or not homosexual men, represented here, are atypical for their sex with respect to this kind of a trait. And are homosexual women different than their heterosexual counterparts with regard to a trait known to be different between men and women? So these are the sexually dimorphic traits that we're going to discuss tonight. And the bottom line message at the outset is that homosexual people are atypical for their sex with regard to these kinds of characteristics. Men and women have different hands, and the index for hand biology is the ratio of the index finger to the fourth finger. It's called the 2D to 4D ratio. Notice that for the individual on your left, the index finger is longer, the index finger is longer than the fourth finger. So the ratio is greater than one. For the individual on the right, the index finger is shorter than the fourth finger, and the ratio of those two is less than one. That's characteristic of men. A ratio greater than one, approaching one or greater than one, is characteristic of women. the ratio less than that is characteristic of men. So these are a small part of the data. And I show it only for women. So this figure, stop looking at your hands and look up at the figure. This is a study that reported the results of 4 independent inquiries from 4 different laboratories. Both the left and the right hands are represented. Homosexual individual data on the right, heterosexual on the left. Let's just look at the right hand. So let's compare those two numbers, those two values, those two, and those two. And what you will see is that lesbian women have their hand ratios masculinized. This ratio is known to first make its appearance in the embryo, and it's stable after about a year and a half. This biological metric is not subject to psychological or sociological change. Nothing that happens in the family alters this characteristic. 3 of these 4 studies show this effect, that this sexually dimorphic trait in women is atypical for their gender. The same thing is true for men. However, it's a little more complicated because some of the studies show that the ratio in homosexual men is masculinized. It's shorter than for heteros. It's smaller than for heterosexual men. Some show that it is feminized. Interestingly, in these studies, the values for the homosexual men is constant from this side of the Atlantic to the other side of the Atlantic, and the difference is in the heterosexual populations. That hasn't been figured out yet. The most recent study that I know from a Finnish study suggests that there may be some ethnic differences. These investigators were not able to see this effect in black or Chinese subjects. There's a difference in handedness. Homosexual people tend to be non-right-handed in comparison to their heterosexual counterparts. I show you the results of a meta-analysis of a large number of studies in which handedness was measured. The results are that, especially for lesbian women, non-right-handedness is greatly increased relative to the heterosexual population. Same with men, but the effect is not as great. Handedness, like finger length, is known to be under the control of exposure to steroid hormones in the embryo. Here's a woman at McFadden's laboratory at the University of Texas at Austin. She has a microphone in her ear, and a recording is being made of the ability of the cochlea in the ear to make noises. The ear just does not hear sounds. The ear can make sounds. Some of these sounds are spontaneous, and some of these sounds are created in response to a little click sound. This woman is being measured for her ability to hear those sounds. The acronym representing the name of these sounds is OAE. Let's not belabor the longer name. Lesbian women are masculinized with respect to their ability in this aspect of hearing. Gay men are not affected. So If we look at the two figures, the top one is for the spontaneous noises in the cochlea. The bottom one is for the noises elicited by the click stimulus. Here are the women over the heterosexual females at the extreme left, heterosexual males at the extreme right. If you look at these three columns in either the top or the bottom panel, you see that gay and bisexual men are not different than heterosexual men. But gay and bisexual women are different than their heterosexual counterparts. Now, there are two other aspects of hearing that deserve brief attention. It's possible to measure other aspects of hearing by putting electrodes on the brain and seeing how the brain interprets sounds. This measure is called AEP. When measures of these same populations are taken, it turns out that bisexual and homosexual women are masculinized with respect to this trait, and for certain, there's a family of these measurements. For some of them, homosexual men are masculinized. There's another aspect of hearing that has the fancy name pre-pulse inhibition. This is the response that people have to a relatively quiet noise if just before that, for some interval of time, they've heard a really loud noise. How startled are they at the second sound, having been exposed previously to the first sound? This can be measured by eye blink. If I were to set off a firecracker in the room, most of you would blink your eyes. So these are the values for heterosexual men on the left and heterosexual women the second to the right. Women don't adjust as readily to the second sound as men do. These are the values for homosexual men in this column and homosexual women in this column. What you will see that there is no difference between homo and heterosexual men, but that lesbians are masculinized. This response can be measured in the embryo. We're down now to number 4 on the right-hand board, cognitive abilities. So this is a test sometimes administered to in various research settings. A table with replicas of common objects are presented, and after a brief period of time, they're covered up, and the subject is asked to remember them. List all of the things that were on that table if you can. Repeatedly and demonstrably, women always outperform men in this kind of a task. The converse is true for cognitive tasks of this sort, where the task is to look in space at various figures and try to find out if two presented at different perspectives are actually the same. Or in the figure to the right, the ability to look at certain lines and see which one of them accurately are represented in the set below. Men reproducibly and demonstrably and carefully outperform women in this kind of a task. And when gay men and lesbians are measured in these, in all of the cases shown here and some others not shown, lesbian women are atypical for their gender, and homosexual men are atypical for their gender. Let's just look at one example. So heterosexual males in the object location memory do poorly. Heterosexual females are the light line. Gay men are just like heterosexual women. And at the bar to the far right, homosexual females are respond in the male direction. With these and other sexually dimorphic traits, the bottom line is that homosexual individuals perform differently than their heterosexual counterparts. One of the most interesting and highly reproducible observations is that gay men have older brothers at a rate that exceeds what is found in the human family worldwide. It's not true for younger brothers. It's not true for older or younger sisters. So the data are these. Here are the ratio, the sibling sex ratios. The dotted line, horizontal dotted line at 106 represents the relative number of males to females in the human family, 106 boys to every 100 girls. For homosexual men, you'll see that the older brother ratio far exceeds that value. None of those values for these three populations are statistically different from zero. I know now of 20 different studies where the older brother effect has been documented. We have a question at the back.
So are you saying that having an older sister, is that a negative effect or just indifferent?
Indifferent.
Okay.
Now, as in many of the studies relative to sexual orientation, things are not simple. It turns out that the older brother effect is only true for gay men who are right-handed. Gay men who are left-handed tend to be firstborn in the family. Now, the effect of this appears to be that when one or the other of whatever is causing this occur in an individual, there's a greater propensity for a homosexual orientation. But when both of these effects are present in the same individual, they tend to cancel each other out. One of the things that we should extract from this information is that there is probably not a single pathway that determines sexual orientation, either homosexual or heterosexual. Handedness is known to be determined in large part by the presence of steroid hormones in the embryo. What could account for the older brother effect? Before I get to mechanism, I should mention, I'm a little ahead of myself, I want to mention this study. This is a study performed by a Canadian investigator and reported in the U.S. Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences a few years ago. This person was able to determine whether or not the older brother effect applied to biological brothers in the same household, biological brothers raised in different households, non-biological brothers raised apart. That category is small. excuse me. Non-biological brothers raised in the same household. The statistical data are here. The older brother effect applies to biological brothers in the same household and only to biological brothers raised apart, as through adoptions. It does not apply to non-biological brothers raised in the same household. This is very strong evidence that the older brother effect is a biological phenomenon and not one related to socialization. So how can it happen? The explanation is hypothetical. It's an immunological explanation. And the proposal is that when a mother carries in an early pregnancy a male child, she starts to make antibodies against it. Every antibody is a foreign body to a pregnant mother, but especially is a male child. She doesn't have a Y chromosome, he does, and proteins synthesized as programmed from Y chromosome genes may then elicit the production of antibodies against that male child. So the diagram shows the analogous situation for the Rh factor. And the proposal is that there is an immunological memory so that in subsequent pregnancies where the embryo is male with an XY chromosome, the titer of antibodies increases over time, and in some subsequent male children, those antibodies have an effect on the reproductive development of subsequent male children. There's not very much evidence for this. Recently, some antigens, some protein products of male offspring have been known to elicit some kinds of immune responses in the mothers, but nothing to validate in a satisfying way to date that this is really the explanation for the older brother effect. Besides the older brother effect, the one observation that has been repeated over and over and over again is that gay and lesbian adults tended to behave in a gender atypical fashion when they were children. This is called childhood gender nonconformity. This is the young boy who turns down an invitation to play catch with his dad and would prefer to dress up in his mom's high heel shoes, or plays with Barbies when given a choice between traditional girl toys and trucks. Nonconformity in young girls takes the form of the tomboy who can beat any kid in the neighborhood in arm wrestling. There are data that I don't have time to report to you suggesting that this effect is the result of a previous commitment to a homosexual orientation, not the result of it. Just a little bit more about that perhaps later on. All right. Now, the question of whether or not these observations have a genetic basis. The tried and true method for making decisions about questions like this come from twin studies. So I can tell you that I know 6 studies now that have looked at twins and tried to determine the concordance between sexual orientation in the two members of a pair. two in the United States, one from a national twin registry in Australia, another one from a twin registry in Sweden, and most recently another one in Finland. They all show the same trend. So that, with a little bit of introduction, (clears throat) 9% of homosexual men tend to have gay brothers. In contrast to this value, which is the most conservative number that I know about the rate of male homosexuality in the Caucasian population. That comes from a very large study done in the United States at the University of Chicago, and it's based on identity. So in tens of thousands of people, not quite 3% of the responding males identified as gay or bisexual, and about half that number for females. This is probably low. If one uses same-gender erotic feelings as an index of homosexuality, then these numbers increase. It's probably a safe estimate for us to believe that somewhere between 3 and 4% of the population are non-heterosexual. Now, back to the twins. So, in one of the studies that I referred to just a minute ago, you can see what the percentages are. Numbers like 9 and 11 are similar to the 9% that you see at the top of the slide. So that's the percent where there is no genetic relationship between the pairs. In fraternal twins, which is like two separate pregnancies that just happen to happen at the same time, the rate increases significantly. And for identical twins, the number approaches or sometimes exceeds 50%. Now, there's something very important I'd like to say about these numbers. They indicate without a doubt that there is a genetic component to homosexuality. There isn't any question about that. The question is, if it's a matter of genes, why isn't the concordance 100%? Why isn't it true that in every case of identical twins, if one of the boys is homosexual, why isn't the other one always homosexual? Well, population geneticists would attribute the variability that one cannot explain by genetics to, quote, environment. And the important message is that environment is not necessarily a non-biological factor. So I've tried to represent that in the following way. Most of the time, I suppose, when any of us were to try to define environment as opposed to genes, we would think of influences outside of the body of the individual. So I've tried to represent those symbolically here by the family. Environment. How mom and dad raised the child. What were the interactions with siblings? But the explanation for why there isn't 100% concordance in the twin studies does not necessarily reside in that explanation for environment. Instead, it may well be, and there is some important evidence to suggest that environment here is within the individual, influences that act on the genetic constitution of that individual. So I've tried to represent that with a double helix of DNA to represent genes here. And here's our friend, the steroid molecule, to represent the fact that hormone exposure in the embryo may represent an, quote, environmental effect that is different between two fraternal twins or two monozygotic twins. Several years ago, this was the cover of Science magazine. It asked, what are the 125 most important questions we haven't figured out yet in science? Five or six of those questions got two or three pages of attention. Our question got a paragraph. And this is what the paragraph said. What is the biological root of sexual orientation? Much of the, quote, environmental contribution to homosexuality may occur before birth in the form of prenatal hormones. So answering this question will require more than just the hunt for gay genes. If you'll forgive the molecular biology professor for a minute, I'm going to show you some pictures of DNA. So, what's a gene? A gene is that thing, that mess, that very complicated part of a chromosome. If I were to take one cell from any of you and extract the DNA and throw away everything that's associated with the DNA and the chromosomes and line up all of the chromosomes end to end, how long would it be? You have 5 seconds to consult with your neighbor and give me an answer. All right. Who's the best power forward in the NBA? Who? If you're a Utah Jazz fan, who was the best power forward in the history of the NBA? Karl Malone is 6'8" tall, and that's how much DNA unwound and straightened in a line is in one nucleus in a cell that you can't see. It's not a bad packing job. And that's responsible for the packing job. And the DNA here is the gray material, and it's wound around this other bag of proteins. And then it gets even worse, because those all wind up in a ball. It's a little bit like the rubber band airplane you had when you were kids, and you would wind up the propeller, and the trick was to wind it one half turn before it broke so that you could fly as far as possible. And what happens to the rubber band motor? It coils up on itself. And genes coil up on itself, and that's what they look like. So this is the task if you're going to turn on a gene. And the analogy has a lot of failures. But just imagine you're a plumber, and in order to turn on a gene, you have to go into that mess, and you have to find out where the start place is, and with your wrench, you pull the switch, and the gene goes on. That's really, 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 really hard to do. And it turns out that there are mechanisms for either making it easier for the plumber to find the start place or harder. There are mechanisms for keeping genes shut off. There are mechanisms for turning them on. And they impact genes on top of this structure. That's why they are called by geneticists epigenetic phenomenon. They exert themselves on top of genes. And so if you just add one carbon and it's accompanying three hydrogens and you stick that on DNA, you can keep the DNA turned off. And if you add things like that, or a phosphate group with some atoms attached, and you attach that to the proteins around which the DNA is bound, you can keep the DNA off or on. And so, Sam and Fred, identical twins with identical genes, may be subjected to epigenetic phenomena such that even though they have the same DNA and they have an identical gene, in one of them the gene may be on and in another gene it may be off. Or it may be on at both times, but it may be on in different locations in the brain. Or it may be at different locations in the brain at different times in the embryonic sequence. There's some supporting data for that I'm not going to talk about. People reluctant to accept a biological explanation for homosexual orientation say, can't be. It violates evolutionary principles. How can a trait that tends to lower reproduction maintain itself in the population? There's a pretty good answer now, and that is that in the maternal line of gay men, the mothers and the grandmothers and the great-grandmothers have more children than their heterosexual maternal counterparts. Something about the genetics of homosexual orientation promote a greater capacity for childbirth. All right. We're going to move on now to ask, is there an explanation? Is there a mechanistic explanation? Nature has provided a couple of very interesting cases of real people with genetic anomalies. We have a question here.
Could you just clarify your last statement? Are you saying the mothers of homosexual men are prone to have more children?
Yes. Repeated twice in studies in Italy and more recently in the United Kingdom.
How does that account then for homosexual?
I'm sorry.
Sorry, how does that account then for homosexual women? If
I don't know of any data that apply to homosexual women with regard to fecundity, with the ability of a genetic, hereditary line of people to have more children. All right, there's a very, I think it's proper to say unfortunate, human condition. This is the acronym. This is the long name. The adrenal gland, that's the gland up in the back, up on top of our kidneys, makes a steroid hormone called cortisol. There's a mutation in these individuals where that doesn't happen. This is what happens. Don't pay any attention to the details. Don't be scared off. All of these elliptical structures represent steps in making steroids. All of the arrows represent the enzymatic machines that make the various steps to make the steroids. One of them doesn't work in individuals with CAH. So it's a little bit like the Detroit assembly line. If one of the workers doesn't show up, then the car is diverted from that pathway and goes somewhere else along the assembly line. And in these people, it goes to testosterone. So these people are exposed to a very, very high, abnormally high level of testosterone during embryonic life. Now, it doesn't seem to impact men, but it has a significant impact on women. I'll read only one of the lines from the discussion of several studies that have demonstrated the same result. The results of our study are consistent with the hypothesis that excessive exposure to prenatal androgens, read testosterone, in women with CAH shifts psychosexual differentiate to a point somewhere in between a female typical pattern and a male typical pattern. These women, many, many, have varying degrees of erotic orientation to women. Now, It's just not the hormone that's involved. In order for the hormone to send its message, it must be captured by the target cell, which then relays the message to the nucleus, where the genes interpret the message. The key molecule is a protein, which is a receptor. So testosterone or estrogen or cortisol, in order to make an impact on that cell, have to get into the cell, bind to the receptor molecule, which then permits it to be relocated to the nucleus, where it finds a place to sit down and causes either a gene to be turned on or a gene to be turned off. There's a condition where there's a genetic mutation in the receptor for testosterone. So think about the consequences for a male. This is a genetic male who's chromosomally masculine. That's a bad sentence, forget it. Chromosomally male, an X and Y chromosome. It can make testosterone, but it doesn't matter. The testosterone can't work because there's no receptor. So you can't target the cell, and the testosterone message doesn't get through. These genetic males have an external reproductive anatomy that's so much like a woman that they are raised female. They don't menstruate. When they don't menstruate, then that's usually the point at which a medical diagnosis is made, and it has determined that these people have this problem. Essentially, uniformly, these genetic males who can't respond to testosterone are raised as women and have sexual attraction to men. That's what your brain looks like from an MRI image. We focus on an organ in the brain called the hypothalamus. It's important for a whole lot of things. None of you would like to be without your hypothalamus. There's a specific part of this organ where there's a collection of nerve endings. It's called a nucleus of nerve endings. It's about the size of a grain of rice. There are a number of these. One of them has this fancy name. A number of years ago, Simon LeVay took samples of the brains of deceased person and measured the volume of this part of the hypothalamus, found that it was sexually dimorphic, and found that gay men were atypical. So this part of the brain of gay men is intermediate in its volume between heterosexual men and women. That's been repeated by William Bine in New York City. These are the data. So the volumes for straight men in black, the volumes for straight women at the right in white, and for gay men intermediate. When Simon LeVay published in Science, this drew a lot of attention from the media and from people everywhere. It was criticized for its strategy, for the way in which the experiment was conducted. Many people were not ready to believe it because a number of the gay men in the study had died from AIDS. So people were asking, does AIDS cause the effect? Bine, in his study, was able to demonstrate that presence of HIV/AIDS has no impact on this result. This is particularly interesting to me because William Bine has been cited repeatedly by LDS social services and others in the LDS community unwilling to accept a biological explanation for homosexuality. And now it turns out that it's his laboratory that replicates the original finding of Simon LeVay. Men's brains and women's brains are not the same. homosexual men's brains are not the same as heterosexual men's brain, and same for women. I'll cite just one study with animals. You can do important things with animals that you can't do with people. 8% of sheep, of male sheep, will not act normally in their reproductive behavior, will not act like the 92% of their brothers who are attracted to ewes, who will mount and ejaculate. These 8% of male-attracted rams won't do that. In fact, they will allow themselves to be mounted by female-attracted rams. So in studies done from populations of animals in northern Idaho and at the University of Oregon, we're going to look at the same measure that I just showed you from the human studies, and that is the size of this area of the hypothalamus. As best we can tell, it's the same in the sheep as it is in the human. There are 1, 2, 3 measures of anatomical structure: volume, number of neurons, and length. This is density. What you can see is that density doesn't show any difference, but the other three show difference. Here are the ewes on the left. The female-oriented rams are in the middle in the dark columns, and here are the, if you will, the gay male sheep. Remember aromatase, the enzyme that receives testosterone in the brain and turns it into estrogen? Thank you. These are measures of the amount of that enzyme in these same animals, and the same conclusion applies. The male-oriented rams are female-like in the amount of this enzyme, and here's an actual measure of how much of this, of the gene that encodes the aromatase enzyme, is expressed. Brains are not the same structurally. Brains are not the same functionally. Finally, investigators in Scandinavia have used PET scans to look at how human brains react to certain compounds that might be pheromones. Think perfumes. Think volatile materials, which you can accept in the insect world are responsible for bringing males and females together. There has been a long-standing controversy about whether or not such things exist in humans. They probably do. So this is a map of the brain. We're looking at the hypothalamus. And there are three geometrical shapes here to represent where the brain is active as measured by PET scan photography when human beings are exposed to two different kinds of compounds. One of them is derived from testosterone. Never mind its name. Another is derived from estrogen. Never mind its name. So, here's the area right here where heterosexual men respond to the compound produced by females. And the domino here hides a third area, which is shown just a little bit in this black rectangle sticking out to the right underneath the domino. And the point is that homosexual men respond to these compounds like women. 2 years after this, they did the same study with lesbians and found the same corresponding effect. Lesbian women respond in their brain when they are smelling these compounds like men, not women. Elder Oaks represents the church with this statement. The church does not have a position on the causes of any of these susceptibilities or inclinations. Sorry, I left out the S. Including those related to same-gender attraction. Those are scientific questions, whether nature or nurture. Those are things the church doesn't have a position on. I don't think I have tried to hide my conclusion about what all of these things mean. It isn't nurture, it's nature. How strong then? How much do we really know? Well, I want to use a comparison. This is what we know about what you have to do if you want to make a steroid. You start with that thing and you turn it to that, to that, to that, to that, and finally you get to cholesterol. Now, that disguises the complexity. If you want to make cholesterol, you start with that and go to there and then to that and then to that. And when you've got that, you go to there and there to there, and then you've got to squalene, and then with a flick of the wrist, you turn squalene into cholesterol. That's not hypothetical. That's not speculative. That's the truth. That's the way we make cholesterol. Nobody studies this anymore. It's a done deal. This is personal to me. This is Conrad Bloch. He won the Nobel Prize for figuring all that out. I'm quite willing to give him the Nobel Prize for figuring all of that out. It was an intellectual and an experimental tour de force. And I have great regard for this good German immigrant. I'm tempted to say something about another subject, but I'll hold my peace. And I got my chance professionally in this man's lab. I was allowed to go in as an undergraduate who didn't know diddly squat and work with a postdoctoral fellow who taught me how to humanely sacrifice a rat, take out its liver, homogenize the liver, make plates for thin layer chromatography to separate the lipids on a plate, how to run the radioactive measuring scintillation counter. So that's the cholesterol pathway. What's the homosexuality pathway? It's clear that what we don't know exceeds what we know by a big margin. There isn't anything about the mechanism of sexual orientation that approaches the biochemical certainty of the cholesterol pathway. But I don't think that's the question to ask now. The question to ask is, do we have enough evidence at this point of our ignorance to say whether or not such a pathway exists? My answer is clearly yes. Those who don't like to accept a biological explanation for sexual orientation, try to use psychological or social explanations. The oldest one are Freudian in origin, anomalies in child rearing are invoked. The most common is that a man is gay because his father was distant or abusive, to compensate, mom became overbearing and overprotective. The thing about those psychoanalytical explanations is that they're not subject to empirical testing. And attempts that have tried to measure this have always failed. It's quite true that a number of gay men recalling their childhood remember some kinds of tensions between themselves and their fathers. I think the more likely explanation is that rather than be causative for homosexuality, this distance, this emotional distance, is reflective of a homosexual orientation. And the disappointment that some fathers may feel that their sons choose not to engage in the kind of man-like activities that dad was always expecting to happen. Likewise, people have invoked learning theories, have suggested that sexual abuse in childhood is responsible with respect to women. Back to Freud for just a minute. Freud had this worked out for men and said almost nothing about homosexuality in women. Although at the end of the day, in writing a famous letter to a woman, he said something important, which is, regardless of the truth of my hypothetical explanations, she wanted to know if he could help her change her homosexual son. And he said, changing this is not likely to happen. Back to sexual abuse as a putative explanation. I understand that there are data to suggest that 1/3 of women in this country have been sexually abused to some extent in childhood or adolescence. I find that so despicable and so unbelievable and so disgraceful. But the evidence seems to be that, for example, there are large numbers of lesbian women who've been abused, but probably no more than heterosexual women. And in the studies that I know about, most of these women, in recalling their childhood experience, said, I believe that I knew I was different than other girls before the abuse took place. On the right and left side of the front podium are stacks of papers, and they describe an organization of some students at BYU and UVU, a few faculty, who meet on the BYU campus weekly. The group is called Understanding Same Gender Attraction. It is not an approved BYU club. It is not sponsored by the university. But it has been this group of people have been permitted to use BYU facilities for their meetings, and their purpose is primarily to support one another with respect to same-gender attraction and to promote healing and to promote education in our community. If any of you are interested in the group or how to contact it, we invite you to take one of these sheets on your way out. I want to now conclude. Tonight, I have laid out some of the compelling evidence that persuades me that sexual orientation is the result of biological mechanisms operating in early human development. My homosexual LDS brothers and sisters did not decide to be gay or lesbian any more than I or my heterosexual LDS brothers and sisters decided to be straight. Sexual orientation is not a choice. Sexual orientation, it is not a disease. It is not an addiction. It is not learned. And the subject for another time, it is not subject to change. Not the least important consequence of this evidence is that it should lift from the souls of parents any undeserved guilt they may feel because of something they did or did not do, believing that something that they did or didn't do was responsible for the orientation of their gay or lesbian children. It's also important to note that there's an alternative, equally valid route to the same conclusion to which we have arrived by means of empirical science. And that is to listen to and believe the honest personal expressions of our gay children. They know that they did not choose to be same-sex attracted. That ought to be good enough. And by comparison, it's certainly a less expensive path to the truth about this issue. I conclude with the hope that we in the LDS community will not remain uninformed about such fundamentally important questions, especially that we will resist what a faculty colleague terms, quote, aggressive ignorance, a willful decision not to investigate. And motivated by knowledge about the various issues surrounding homosexuality, shouldn't we all commit to a greater outpouring of respect, sensitivity, and Christian kindness towards these people who are so often marginalized in our community? Although it will be grossly inadequate, I would like to be witness to the integrity, decency, and moral goodness of my gay and lesbian brothers and sisters, both in and out of Mormondom. The record states that in ministering to the little children of the Nephite people, Jesus spoke words, quote, so great and marvelous, quote, that they could not be verbalized nor written by others, so we are left to our imaginations in fathoming their content. What happened next, however, suggests that the themes were love, both divine and human, and mercy. Having wept, quote, he took their little children one by one and blessed them and prayed unto the Father for them. And when he had done this, he wept again. End of quote. Knowing what we know today, we have to believe that among those children were a few who later as young adults would have to confront and cope with their homosexuality. I can further imagine that they would not have forgotten that extraordinary experience from their childhood, and that the memory of the Savior's great love for them would have assuaged their effort to deal with their recognition of being different. And they would have known that they did belong to Him and to all the rest of the human family. Thank you very much. That was more than kind. Thank you very much. You've been here a long time, but we'd be happy to hear your comments or questions. I'd do my best to answer any questions that you have. Sir?
I think as church members, I appreciate a lot the explanation of a biological cause that's nobody's decision or fault. And I think to feel those tendencies, nobody decides. It's just something you're born with. So I think that was very well established. And I think as a church member, the next question is, I think still from a gospel standpoint, we believe to practice homosexuality, to commit sexual acts with another someone of the same gender, especially outside of marriage, which we don't accept, is still a sin. So what does the church, or at least your opinion, what is expected of someone who feels that attraction and it isn't their fault, but how are they supposed to cope with it? Or how is...
Can you imagine anything more challenging?
I cannot.
What I will say in response to this question is these are the choices. Remain active in the church by adopting a celibate life. Or practice indiscriminate sexual behavior with someone of the same gender, or adopt a committed monogamous relationship. I find it very difficult for Latter-day Saints to recommend celibacy to anyone, given our...
Why don't you fast for the rest of your life? That's what it's like saying. Why don't you just go without the shame from food for the rest of your life? That's what it's like. That seems
good. I can't say it better. Thank you. However, for a Latter-day Saint man or woman who finds this the best solution in their life, I have nothing but admiration. I don't recommend the second alternative. And I can tell you with absolute certainty that Latter-day Saint parents of gay and lesbian children want desperately for their children who do not find celibacy as a solution to their circumstance, desperately want those children to find a monogamous, committed relationship. The thing I want to say most in answer to your question, which is very complicated and which I have not addressed very well, is I would like to see my gay brothers and sisters, no matter what their circumstance, sitting next to me in sacrament meeting. Someone else.
I was told not to return to church when I came out to my bishop. So it's with I don't want to ruffle anybody's feather. I've taken steps out and they've made their choice, but I'm not going to.
That's not the first time I've heard such a story, and I have to tell you, I grieve because of it. Sir?
So, at the beginning of the lecture, you mentioned that this is just to answer one of the three main questions that you posed at the beginning. Are there planned lectures for the other two questions, possibly, or?
Not to my knowledge. They are topics that need to be talked about. One of my hopes in coming tonight would be that we would overcome the reluctance in our community to talk about this issue. That we would adopt not just a civil discourse, but a discourse that recognizes the basic decency of all people, including our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters. Yes, ma'am.
So if homosexuality is biological, what does it mean for other types of sexual attractions. Like, does that mean like a pedophile is also biological?
The first thing to say is the evidence is very clear that pedophilia is not more common in the homosexual community than it is in the heterosexual community. Homosexual people are not pedophiles. Some are. Some heterosexuals are. They are not synonymous. There is a smaller body of evidence, of which I am mostly ignorant, that pedophilia also has a genetic component. I can't say any more than that because I'm ignorant. Sir?
I'm curious to know, scientifically, when I was an infant, before I spoke or walked, my father would leave for, ironically, church meetings. I would immediately develop a fever of about 102 degrees, and that would stay until he returned home. Are there studies about at what point the child is cognizant of a stress between a father and a son?
The question is about the timing of recognition of being different in children. What I know about this subject is that gay men and women looking back on their childhood almost universally identify some point in their childhood when they recognize some difference between themselves and other children. I don't think that that means that they had an intellectual understanding of what that difference was, nor did they associate it with romantic feelings. Sometimes this takes the form of a sense of just not belonging, sort of being on the margin of the groups. And sometimes it takes the form of recognition of childhood gender nonconformity. For some people, the point in time is very young. This is 3 or 4 or 5 or 6. I don't know that it's possible to cite an average age. But then, in later adolescence, this difference, as one struggles with sexual feelings, then gay people tend to associate the difference that they have self-diagnosed to be homosexuality. And then comes the nearly always the struggle to ask, who really am I, and how am I going to live my life? Sir?
There are some people that identify as being bisexual, and if they identify as being bisexual, does that mean that the biological aspect of men to be female or women to be lesbian, is it the same factors that cause them to be just in the middle?
I think the question is are the same factors that we think are responsible for homosexuality also responsible for a person being bisexual? I just don't think there's enough information. There are disagreements about how many bisexual people are represented among non-heterosexuals. I do know that there are many therapists whose experience is that those people who can succeed in opposite orientation marriages tend to be bisexual. And with therapeutic help or counseling or by private force of will, are able to focus on one of the two orientations, the two sets of romantic feelings that they're capable of. I would remind everybody about the fact that gay and lesbian and bisexual people are a small proportion of the population. And finding samples of such people in sufficient quantity to make statistically valid comparisons is a daunting task. Yes, sir.
In doing my homework for coming tonight, I was looking up studies about this topic, and I found an overwhelming number of them cited early sexual trauma as being more prevalent among the gay and lesbian population than in the general population. You kind of touched on that a little bit in your lecture. Can you speak a little bit more about that?
The conventional wisdom for those who adopt this explanation is that if a young female child is sexually abused by a male, she will be traumatized by this and turn her romantic attentions toward women. The data that I know don't support that because a significant proportion of the abuse is female to female. But the worst thing is that this isn't subject to empirical testing very well. You can try to establish the correlation. The correlations fluctuate from study to study. In many, they're not impressive. We don't know everything, but that doesn't, from what I know from the literature, that doesn't seem to be a very plausible explanation. Not a great answer. That's the best thing I know how to say. Sir?
Do you have any thoughts on last weekend's Evergreen International Conference?
Yes.
Would you care to follow up? Would you care to expand upon me?
No. I've been turning in this direction. I should turn in this direction. Yes, sir. Would you start again, sir? I'm sorry, I didn't.
Have there been any cross studies within other ethnicities to support your findings?
The question is, are the findings supported by studies across ethnicities? And the answer is yes. Homosexuality seems to have been part of the human condition from the very beginning. Whenever that was. You can imagine that the academic studies have been performed most often in Western countries. They all seem to agree in general principle to what I have cited tonight. In spite of cultural differences, and I've just thought of two more things I want to say in response to the question about sexual abuse. A study among the people of Zambia, almost Stone Age culture, is instructive because in this culture, adult to child, male-male homosexual practice is common as part of growing up. And it is believed by this people that as a rite of passage into manhood, a child must ingest semen. In spite of years of this kind of sexual behavior among these people, when these young boys grow up to be men, they universally marry and behave sexually as men. It's also true that when studies have been performed in English boarding schools, same-gender boarding schools, where apparently same-gender experimentation is quite frequent, there is no correlation between that activity and the sexual orientation of those men and women as adults. The lady here.
Just really fast. So sexual orientation is not defined as sexual behavior necessarily then?
The question is about the definition of sexual orientation, and that becomes a non-simple issue. So there tend to be three measures: sexual behavior, sexual identity, and sexual feelings. It seems to me that the most reasonable of these is sexual feelings. Sexual behavior, there are clearly gay and lesbian women, gay men and lesbian women who are celibate. One cannot use the absence of sexual behavior to define them. Sexual identity is probably even trickier. There are men who probably are fives and six on the Kinsey scale. They are people who, by reasonable judgment, are gay men who say about themselves, "I'm not a gay man. I'm a heterosexual who's struggling. I'm someone working my way, transitioning out of homosexuality. I'm not really one of those." That's just one example of how identity can be problematic, and so. What I know about the most recent studies is that there is an attempt to assess all of these in subjects who admit to some degree of same gender attraction. Sir?
I am an active LDS member, and I believe that the church can offer a lot of good things, and a lot of things that you said in your lecture really touched me. A couple being that homosexuality is not a disease. And also that our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters belong in our community and don't need to be ostracized. And I believe in those things. I agree with you very strongly about that. And I'm wondering, do you have any advice for someone within the LDS community who wants to make a difference and help build bridges and erase barriers and allow our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters to feel welcome at church without someone like me appearing to be kicking against the pricks or rejecting the brethren or being scandalous?
I don't know you. I don't know your name. I don't know anything about you. My answer to your question is be who you are and who you portray yourself to me right now. And follow the best instincts of your heart and follow whatever revelatory help Heavenly Father can give you as to how to proceed. In the back.
I really like the studies you presented. Is there a way we could maybe find a list of those studies and read more in depth and show them to other people?
There's a yellow pad of paper on the front desk on your way out. If you'd like to leave your contact information, I would do my best to provide you with such information. Gentleman in the brown.
I was reading something one time, and it talked about especially about depression, and a woman recounted basically when she started taking antidepressants, having a change in, well, she said she used to have a lot of strange sexual thoughts, and it changed when she was on the antidepressants. Is there any correlation between homosexuality and any of the mental diseases that exist? Not that homosexuality is a disease, but some mental ones.
I alluded to the complexity of some of the issues, and that's certainly one. And there are people in this room who know a lot more about that than I. I read a paper last night. The research question was, is anxiety and depression in adults correlated with homosexual orientation or childhood gender nonconformity? The greater correlation was with the latter, acting different than your same gender peers as a child. The interesting part of this for me was that the levels of anxiety and depression in heterosexual people, male and female, who in their childhood years exhibited nonconformity was at the same level as homosexual adults who had the same experience. At the heart of this question, I think there's no doubt that homosexual people, including Latter-day Saints, as adults, go through traumatic experiences emotionally in their lives that heterosexual people don't. The question is why? Is it because those mental challenges go along for the ride with being gay? I think the answer is no. I think the answer most likely resides in the fact that these people experience a level of societal disapproval that most of us can't even imagine. There are other people in this room who could be much more helpful than I on this issue. Yes, sir. I'm sorry, I missed it.
Is there a way to get access to the video that's being recorded tonight?
I don't know the answer to that. If you're interested, why don't you use the sheet here, and I'll try to respond when I know. And again, may I remind any who are interested of this contact information for the student group? Yes, sir.
I wish this was more scientific of a question, but how do we as LDS members help our fellow members when it's actually our church selling data that's saying that 30% of pedophiles are gay? In this book, it's being sold through the Deseret bookstore, Stand for the Family, and this lady is stating some supposed research that says that homosexuals make up 30% of pedophiles. How do we help our brothers and sisters see through this stuff that's being sold through our bookstores?
Number one, satisfy yourself about what the truth is. You can read the papers. Sometimes they're a little tricky, but you can skip over some of the hairy statistical stuff and get to the conclusions. Satisfy yourself about what's true. And then don't stay silent in elders' quorum when something's said that's wrong. Yes, sir.
Well, I can tell your conclusions and from some of your evidence leads you at odds with the majority of the church membership or even some of the general authorities. Would you be willing to share some of your feelings of what you've had to deal with being at odds with your position?
Being odd is really a burden. Elder Oaks says the church doesn't have a position on the question we addressed tonight. I take him at his word. Clearly, there are differences. I guess I'm going to refer to the same formula. Find out what's true, and don't be afraid to express it. Isn't that what the purpose of this university is? Please.
I've met a lot of KLDS people who have found one of their best choices to be suicide. And having to, and many have attempted this many times, and they're scared to death to talk to their family, to their church leaders, to anyone, to their school, for fear that they'll be rejected, and also that they're going to hurt the people that they love by telling them this, by disappointing them. What would you say to somebody that came to you and said that this is their the best option they can see, the one that would hurt the least amount of people? How would you respond to that?
To one of my gay brothers and sisters who was contemplating suicide? The question is about suicide, and what might be said to people whose lives have reached the point where inexplicably, or at least sadly beyond belief, they find this as their only option. I know what I do first. I throw my arms around this person and hug them to me as close as I could and say, I love you, and don't you do it. You have one person who cares about you, and you have a lot more that you don't know about who care about you. Give a little bit more credit to your parents. If they don't respond at first, give them a few months. Give them a few years. I'm sure you would all find better things than I could at the moment to say in response. How can the Latter-day Saints rationalize having our gay brothers and sisters take their lives because they are so marginalized or have such a sense of being unwanted that they can't go on? What better way could we fulfill our baptismal covenant to mourn with those that mourn than to mourn with these people who have been subjected to so much? I will also offer my opinion that my Heavenly Father has special blessings in store for these people in recognition of how valiant they are and what goodness they have made of their lives in spite of the extraordinary challenge that they face in this life. You've sat here for a very long time. And some of you need to go home and study. And some of you have kids that need to be tucked in bed. Thank you so much for coming. I hope Heavenly Father will help us all to do better. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to discuss it with others, please check us out online at mormonstories.org. If you want to find other friends, family members, former missionary companions, or ward members who approach Mormonism like you, consider adding me, John DeLynn, as your Facebook friend. This may seem like a strange idea, but many of my closest friends have discovered that they are not alone in their thoughts or feelings or family or even ward situation through discovering mutual Facebook friends. Finally, to keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider a donation at mormonstories.org. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton.
Nearer, my God, to thee, nearer to thee, even though it be a cross that raiseth me, still